Hello and welcome to the Opening Bell, the Boxing News Podcast. We're back. 3 years away, but we return ala Muhammad Ali, ala Tyson Fury, to reclaim our old glories. My name is Matt Christie. I'm the editor of Boxing News, the oldest boxing magazine in the world. 110 years old, and I like to think 110 years old. Wise. And the man with me isn't quite that old. It's the one and only Mr. Alex Steedman.
Matt, thank you. Hello, everybody. Yes, we've been talking about this for a number of years, getting this project off the ground. We discussed it, my first big fight trip to Vegas, 2015, November of that year, when we both went out to see Cotto against Canelo. And we spent many an hour in the press room and indeed in the bars down the strip afterwards talking about getting this podcast going. The fates and one or two other things have intervened in the period between then and now. We almost had it off the ground and were just days away from doing so 2 years ago until once again we were cruelly denied and that sponsor had to pull out at the very, very last minute. But we're here and hopefully it's going to be worth the wait for everyone. Lots to look forward to in the coming weeks. Regularly, we're going to talk about the big fights coming up, the fights that have been, all the latest news, and we'll be speaking to the great and the good of the boxing world as well with in-depth interviews each and every week. So I'm really looking forward to it. And we kickstart, Matt, with one of the biggest breaking stories of the COVID period. And that is, in recent days, the story that landed on your lap from the Warrens. Wanting to link up with Matchroom to try and put forward and put together some of the best fights that can be made domestically and indeed internationally as well. A bolt from the blue, I suspect, a surprise for you too.
Yeah, it was. And when stories kind of come along like this that are a surprise, they're not usually you're not digging around for them. You stumble across them. And yeah, I spoke to George Warren yesterday for a completely different reason. We got talking, and then this news emerged about what they were planning to do that evening, and that in essence was to call out Matchroom, and we're going to have to see where it goes. But as news breaking, particularly after quite a quiet few months, this was pretty huge.
George, potentially exciting news for fans as Queensbury Promotions and BT have offered to work with Matchroom and Sky Sports. How did this idea come about?
Good question. I think it's something that's been in the back of our mind for some time. And, you know, you look at the traction and the engagement of boxing fans online and what they're saying about a lot of the things. I think one of the things they feel frustrated about is, you know, certain allegiances to broadcasters and to promotional companies sometimes gets in the ways of fight happening. I think what we're trying to get out there, and we're doing this in a positive way. This isn't about trying to create problems down the road. This is about trying to make stuff happen. But for us, this is about saying we are open to exploring ways and opportunities to work with competitors to make sure these fights get made and can happen.
And is this an olive branch between two of Britain's biggest promoters, or is it an economic necessity?
To be honest, I'm not sure if it's either. There's always going to be a natural rivalry between Queensbury and Matchroom. You know, that's an historic thing. We are competitors, and that competition's good for the sport. We drive each other to create good boxing fights and to deliver the best that we possibly can within the budgets that we work with our broadcast partners. I think this is really about now looking at what is happening in the current climate across a lot of sports, but obviously boxing in particular. We are all having to adapt to what's going on around the world. We don't know how long these restrictions are going to last. We don't know how long, you know, we're going to have issues with regards to capacity crowds at venues. When are they going to be able to be opened up? And ultimately, boxing fans still want to see the best possible content that they can. Now, we're very confident working with BT, the stable that we have, that we can deliver great, great content and continue to do so. We've had a tremendous relationship with them so far. But this is for us now going that step further. And they're on board to have, you know, top line discussions with us and, you know, with Sky Matchroom about some of these crossover fights and to see what we can come up with between each other to deliver some great events, you know, whether that be across different, you know, different pay-per-view events, cross promotion with regards to both platforms, distributing events collectively, building cards together, or even a series of fighters, you know, that we've got under our roster potentially going over and fighting on Sky and vice versa. For us, this is just about getting it out there that this is good for boxing. This is good for boxing fans. It's good for our stable. I don't see any downside with trying to investigate, at the very least, how we can make some of these fights happen. So we've made our feelings about this very public and very clear. We are welcoming conversations, and we'd be happy to have them sooner rather than later.
And what's the reaction been like from fans as well as those within the sport?
I think it's been overall fairly positive. You know, there is definitely an appetite to see a lot of these fights. You know, we throw out, I think, 9 or 10 different fights that we feel are there to be made. I think it's hard to say that any of them aren't attractive to the British boxing public. I think everyone would have to admit that they're fights that are of interest and that people would want to watch. People would be interested in seeing some of them. Everyone's going to have an opinion on the outcome of those. We've got full confidence in the stable that we work with. We're obviously going to fancy our guys in the fights. And I would imagine that, you know, Matchroom are going to fancy their guys in theirs, but that's what makes it so attractive. And in addition to that, you've obviously do have that, that natural competition narrative that sits above all of this between Matchroom and Queensbury that just adds to it. And I think builds more interest into some of these fights if we can make them happen.
Do you see this as a way of funding the biggest fights, or do you think that it can work across the board?
I think it can work across the board. I mean, you know, is there any reason why we can't take yield from what's happened in America? You know, it's happened previously. It's happened very recently. We've seen cross, networks working together to deliver pay-per-view events. Off the top of my head, Tyson Holyfield was done between HBO and Showtime. We saw that again with Mayweather Pacquiao. And very recently, obviously, with Fury Wilder 2, where Fox and ESPN collaborated and delivered and distributed a pay-per-view event to make sure a great fight was made. That, for me, is an obvious blueprint for us to be able to follow. And I see no reason why we can't, at the very least, explore those conversations as a collective group to see what can happen.
Let's get back to business closer to home then. You've had Brad Foster in a British title fight and Lyndon Arthur defending his Commonwealth belt in the first couple of BT Queensbury promotions. What have you got planned for the coming months?
Well, we're in very good shape. I mean, it's been difficult. It's been a real, real challenge. Certainly one of the biggest challenges I've ever faced since I've been working in the game. I think even, you know, my dad would probably admit himself that he's obviously been doing this a lot longer than I have. But, you know, we got on with it. The plan, and for us, the most important thing right at the beginning of this was to get going as soon as possible so that we could deliver opportunities for our young stable. I think the first event, as an example, the Foster card that you mentioned, the average age of the fighters on there, I think, was 21 or 22 years old. You know, a lot of them hadn't had the exposure before on TV, but the real crux of why we wanted to get going quickly with a succession of fights in July was to get these guys out earning and fighting again. You know, they've got mortgages and, you know, bills to pay like everyone else. This has been very difficult on them, in particular the younger guys as they're coming through. They require work, as in fights, to be able to earn a living. So that was the focus for us. We've got those three events under our belt now. We move on now with a slightly adjusted budget and mindset and what we're trying to do now. And we're going to see, for us, a far better, I would say, quality in terms of the event being put together with some real high profile names. Carl Frampton's up on August 15th. Mick Conlon's also going to be on that card. Archie Sharp's got a really interesting fight on that. And there's some natural fights potentially down the road between some of those guys that I've just mentioned. So that's a narrative in itself that we want to build on. Daniel's fighting August 29th. We're going to be back in September with at least two more events and in October. And, you know, we're all still fingers crossed that we might be able to do Dubois Joyce in front of a crowd at the O2 on the 24th of October. Having said that, we're going to have to wait and see, because it's pretty challenging to to look further than a couple of weeks ahead right now. But, you know, we've got to be optimistic. And for us now, we've got those first series events away. It's about building on that, creating better quality, making sure we're delivering for our broadcaster a better product, the best product that we possibly can. And that's what we're going to aim to do.
And you would get that, George, if Eddie Hearn and Matchroom entertain this idea. Have you had any kind of response from them?
Not at the moment. I mean, where are we? It's coming up to 11:30 and our, obviously, our statement and social media post went out quite late last night. So I wasn't expecting anything now. You know, we sit here and we hope that they do engage. This is genuine from us. We're absolutely interested in trying to make some of these fights happen. I would love to see them all. I'm sure boxing fans would love to see them all. And, you know, let's not forget there's a host of other potential fights that could be done as well that we haven't even mentioned, including a lot of the other guys that we have under our roster and that they have there as well. So for us, this is just, you know, an open invitation to open up dialogue. Let's have some sensible conversations and let's see if we can do anything.
Yeah, that's the most encouraging thing for me. And all the fights are appealing, without question. But it's that opening up of the dialogue between you that has been elusive until now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had historic times where the two organisations have been able to work together. There is, because of that natural competition between the organisations, we do get into some scenarios where there is a bit of tit for tat. We've made offers for fighters. They've made counter offers or opening offers that we've then countered. But ultimately, a lot of the time, the fights haven't happened. You know, I cast my mind back to when we were still working with Terry Flanagan and they had Anthony Crolla. And we made a similar proposal at the time then. It was before our time working with BT. We were with Box Nation and we extended the opportunity to try and make that fight. And even offered to allow Sky to be the broadcaster of it. It didn't end up happening. You know, it's not for me to criticise people, but for some reason, a lot of the times we've seen these fights not get made. We've got an upcoming situation at the moment with Nigel Benn and Chris Jenkins, and there's a lot of talk about offers that we've received. We've also made offers for that fight to happen on BT that have been turned down. So ultimately, where we are at the moment, I would say, is that, you know, the majority of the time, whether the intent to make the fights is there or not, the ultimate thing that isn't happening is these fights aren't happening. So I would say that what we're trying to do here is open up a situation where, as a collaborative effort, let's try and get some of these fights made and as many of them as possible.
Conor Benn mentioned there, and of course, Ant Crawler against Terry Flanagan before. And George, you also touched there on international collaboration, the likes of which we saw between TV companies and, of course, Pacquiao and Mayweather for the biggest events. With Sky and BT Sports, how do you envisage that actually working?
I think it's a combination of it all. I mean, to your point about BT and how easy was it to get them on board, I mean, we've had very top-line discussions with them. We haven't gone into the nitty-gritty details as to how this, you know, this potential situation could get dealt with. What we have, though, got with them is a great broadcast partner that supports us in trying to deliver boxing fans and particularly BT Sport customers the best quality and best product we possibly can. If that means that we've got to collaborate with Matchroom on certain fights and work together, then that's what we should be doing. It's for the betterment of the sport. You know, BT and Sky share rights in a number of other sports properties. I see no reason why we can't be at least at the table discussing a similar situation in boxing. Again, you know, to the point of what they've done in the US before, pay-per-view, the distribution point for me is really, really simple. You would want, in my opinion, and, you know, as a promoter, as a running a promotional business, I would want both broadcasters involved. I would want both of their promotional powerhouses behind this thing. I would want, you know, BT engaging with their huge EE database. I would want Sky pumping this out on Sky Sports News. That, for me, is only going to improve the access and the quality of the events and possibly the money that we can put on the table for the fighters. But there is obviously going to have to be a situation where, you know, particularly with some of the smaller guys, you know, the ones that aren't necessarily ready to headline pay-per-view, where we might have to let certain fights go on Sky. But for that to happen, for me, it also has to come the other way. And I think rather than focusing on a fight-by-fight basis, this for us is really more a general point of saying, we want to try and make this happen. You know, do you? And if the intent's there and everyone wants to do this and wants to have sensible discussions about trying to find ways of doing this, then let's start those conversations as soon as possible.
And you mentioned the fighters there, George. Are they on board with all of this? Are they being realistic about pay in the current climate?
I mean, you know, I don't really like to comment on, you know, on contractual purses and payments with fighters. We'll sit down with their teams. You know, look, it's like everything. Everyone's got to be fairly sensible in the current climate. There are obviously certain fights that require capacity crowds and that are going to need live audiences. There are certain others that perhaps don't need that. And, you know, as long as everyone as a collective wants to work together to get fights and to get these guys out and fighting, then I'm sure we'll see some great fights. I think for me, the important thing that I've seen is since we've obviously put this out and had the conversation with some of our guys, they're of course all interested in this. Why would they not be? They're in boxing, not only to make money, but to be involved in big events and big fights and to challenge themselves and to reach the pinnacle of the sport. And some of these fights can help them get to that point. So yeah, I don't see any pushback, certainly from the Queensbury stable of guys. And, you know, obviously the guys that we focused on yesterday as part of our social post about trying to make this happen.
George, it's a fascinating story, and it could be wonderful for the sport and for fans if it can get off the ground. Our fingers are crossed. We really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on.
Not at all. Good to speak, guys.
Well, it sounds fantastic, Matt. And it is, of course, entirely reliant on that big if, and can it be put together? And will Eddie Hearn be interested? Certainly the fans will. Let's just allow ourselves to dream a little. We've been teased and tantalised. Let's just go with it for a bit. How good potentially is this for boxing fans?
Yeah, on paper, it's excellent. The biggest problem, aside from the drugs in boxing, aside from the multiple world titles, is the fact that these big superpowers never ever want to work together. Now and again it happens. Now and again we get these super events. For me, I can see that each of those 10 fights are all very, very appealing. Now, the big question, of course, is what will Eddie Hearn make of them? The timing of them, we have to, I think, be a little bit suspicious of. This came 2 or 3 days after Eddie Hearn had launched his own comeback. He had this fantastic show in his garden. Now he's being presented with this news that he needs to react to. Now, will he take kindly to being asked about his promotional rivals in the days where he's actually now building up to part two of Matchroom Fight Camp? That's another matter entirely. I'm not sure. Ultimately, what we have to hope for. Now, we can hope for those 10 fights to happen. They're not impossible fights by any stretch. But what we want is that line of communication to be developed between them. Now, George was saying the right things there. We hope that Eddie Hearn will say the right things. There is a part of me that wonders if this would have been even better news if we'd have heard that they'd made the approach via a telephone call or via an email, that had some positive news back, and then it was going this way, rather than this kind of let's call them out on social media thing. But ultimately, someone had to make that first step. And the fact is that step has been made. That is great news for the sport.
And it could be great news for fans as well, if it can just be taken. The baton can be picked up and it can be taken to the next level. What have you made of their respective starts post-lockdown? They've gone about it in very different ways. I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about the studio setup in Stratford. Actually, I enjoyed it. And maybe having been around the world commentating on elite amateur boxing, where there's not always huge crowds, maybe I'm maybe more used to that than some other boxing fans would be. But I didn't find it sterile. I actually quite enjoyed hearing every punch land and hearing the physical efforts of the fighters at themselves too. So I quite like that. And Eddie's Garden had that very much big fight feel about it, almost a set up for pay-per-view occasion too. I think they came at it different angles. What did you make of it?
I think that both should be deemed a success. I think that when Frank Warren came back, it was best part of a month ago now. So things have changed a little bit that in terms of what's allowed, what isn't. And let's not forget that when you're the first one to come back, you're then, in essence, you're creating lessons for those that follow. But what we have seen, what I like with BT is that they seem to have got their sound right after a bit of experimentation. What I really like with the BT broadcast is you can hear the punches. You can hear the instructions coming from the crowd. And the thing is, as you and I have been ringside several times, we're exceptionally lucky to be able to say that. Not everybody can say that. Not everybody has that benefit of or that horror of hearing what it sounds like when a punch lands and you're so close to it. I mean, I remember being at several fights where my opinion will differ. The first one that comes to mind is Anthony Joshua against Carlos Takam, when I had heard Anthony Joshua's punches quite literally crunch off Carlos Takam's skull for so long that when it was stopped, even though Takam may not necessarily have been in obvious trouble, I thought that's the perfect stoppage. That's enough of that. I've seen enough. Then the people that are watching on TV think it's a ludicrously premature stoppage. But yeah, so that's what I like about the BT ones. I thought that what Eddie Hearn did well, he put on a show. It looked wonderful. I think the biggest lesson here for both of them is that it, like you, it didn't bother me particularly that there was no crowd there. But what worked in the BT studios is exactly what worked in Eddie Hearn's back garden, and that was when you got a well-matched fight. Now, does that tell us that we don't need a crowd, we just need a well-matched fight? I think the boxers need the crowd perhaps more than people that are watching on television. But if we're going to be doing it in this environment for the foreseeable future without crowds, the fights have to be matched perfectly. And that's what Eddie Hearn got right. And that's what BT Sport, more often than not, over the course of their three shows have done as well. I think both at this point, with the difficulties they're facing, deserve nothing but massive credit.
You mentioned the sound of punches landing there. I remember being 3-4 feet away from David Price when he landed that big right hand on Audley Harrison. And I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night with that sound thwacking in my ears and a little bit of sweat on my brow as well. I shall never, ever forget that punch landing. Let's talk about some of the punches that have landed in some of the fights that we've seen over the last few weeks. BT last Friday, and you had that light heavyweight encounter between Lyndon Arthur. He defended his Commonwealth belt for the first time against Dex Spellman, who's won and lost the English title. You knew what you were going to get from Spellman. We were looking forward to seeing what Arthur was capable of doing on the next big stage in his career. And he really did deliver, didn't he? Lots of class. The jab was terrific, often followed by that uppercut through the middle. He was comfortable on the ropes, but it was the jab, really, that was the story of the whole fight. And it's perhaps going to be the story of his career going forward.
You could make an argument that Spellman on volume alone may have just edged the first round. But after that, it was all about that beautiful Lyndon Arthur jab. And he said afterwards that he injured his hand. And I made a note, actually, as I was watching along with it, that it seemed that Arthur's right hand wasn't as lively from about round 5-6 onwards. But if you watch that fight back, if he was a one-arm fighter, he was exceptionally impressive. The way that he was throwing that jab, going forward, going backwards, was excellent. But he also seemed to increase the power behind it as the fight progressed. There were times where I thought that Lyndon Arthur could have perhaps have done more. If he had that hand injury, then he did all that he could. Spellman, what a brave, brave fighter. He never stopped coming forward. But the other thing that really impressed me about Lyndon Arthur is that Spellman, alongside his trainer Carl Greaves, had come up with a pretty decent plan to stifle and counter Lyndon Arthur. Now they managed. Well, sorry, Spellman managed to get into position. He even managed to throw punches, but it was very, very rare that even though he was throwing plenty, he was landing any more than one at a time. And at one point, it was almost like as Arthur's leaning back on the ropes and his defense and he's swatting away the punches, and it becomes almost like one of those extravagant Floyd Mayweather pad routines. It was very, very good to watch. It was engrossing, if not exciting, but I couldn't take my eyes off it.
Yeah, he's happy on the back foot. He did it when he won the title previously as well. Maybe slightly too much so. Maybe the right uppercut coming through on the back of the jab was repeated one too many times and too often. Maybe some others will be able to maneuver him around the ring, and maybe they'll look upon that as predictable. But I think he's clearly talented, and he might be the sort of guy that can rise to the occasion. And he'd have to do that if a mooted fight against Anthony Yard is going to be forthcoming in the autumn. Sounds to me like they're trying to engineer that on the Joyce Dubois bill, maybe as a pay-per-view.
It's a brilliant fight. It really, really is. It's right up there with kind of domestic clashes that I want to see. You'd have to make Anthony Yard the favourite. And we put it out there on Twitter, I think just after Lyndon Arthur had won the unanimous decision after 12 rounds. Okay, you've seen Lyndon Arthur in action. How do you think he's going to get on with Anthony Yard? And I would say, I don't think one person came back and said that Lyndon Arthur would win it. But I think Lyndon Arthur's schooling is exceptional. We know he was a quality amateur. And I'm not saying I would pick Lyndon Arthur at this juncture, but it's a lot closer fight than I think a lot of people are saying. I'd make Lyndon Arthur worthwhile backing in that one.
I'll tell you how far Lyndon Arthur's come as well in the last 3 years. I remember commentating on the Joseph Parker Huey Fury world title fight up in Manchester. Lyndon Arthur was the float that night. And I remember going backstage very early on, would have been half past four, something like that, in the afternoon to try and speak to one or two of the fighters, get some quotes and some tidbits for commentary later on. And Arthur, as the float, was already backstage. He was sitting on a chair out in the kind of area just before you make your ring walk. And he had his top off and he was gloved up and ready to go. So I went across to kind of speak to him for a bit, and he wasn't really, that would be sort of 10, 11, 12 fights or so into his career. He wasn't really aware of what the float situation was that night. He didn't know whether he had to wait, didn't know when he was going on. And really, he was just sitting there waiting for the call. And it gives you an idea of kind of what goes on behind the scenes and how difficult it is sometimes for these young guys when they're coming through the ranks. And he's obviously gone through that experience better for it. And now he's got a title and he's going to be looking to launch onto a bigger one.
I mean, really, I mean, the way you explain it there, I mean, we're used to that kind of scenario with those floats. But sometimes these guys don't even get on. They can be sat there waiting from kind of on call almost from 4 o'clock, and then the show overruns, and it's not uncommon for these young boxers actually not to appear after a long night of waiting. And yeah, I mean, it's not the nicest place to be, is in a boxing dressing room waiting to go out in front of people and fight. But you know, sitting there for 6 hours and they're not actually getting to at the end of it, I would imagine is pretty difficult.
Boxing's tough mentally at the best of times, but there's lots goes on behind the scenes as well that adds into the mix too. Let's talk about the following night. Matchroom Square Garden, Eddie's back garden, Weekend at Herney's, I heard someone say. It's quite a good one. I like that. That's one of the best. And we had some cracking fights too, didn't we? I mean, it was set up. It looked fantastic. And in the end, we got the fights kind of befitting of the occasion too. And none more so than the top of the bill when Sam Eggington and Ted Cheeseman took each other on. It was a crackerjack of a fight. And to be honest, it could have gone either way. It was very tight on the cards. And it's the sort of fight you wouldn't really be shy of seeing it a second or indeed a third time.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, I think it was one of those fights where, as much as I love boxing, I do sometimes watch through my fingers sometimes, just this, you're aware of the punishment that these guys are taking. Therefore, you have nothing but admiration for you. But then I must admit, when the final bell went, there was a little bit like, oof, thank goodness for that. You know, you've given yourself a headache with the tension. You're imagining what these guys are going through. And I do think that a rematch wouldn't wouldn't be quite as exciting. But we've seen it with Sam Eggington numerous times in these exciting fights. He's taken punches, he's come back. Exactly the same with Ted Cheeseman. And what a story Ted Cheeseman is with all the problems that he's come through to get that victory. Personally, I think after about 10 or 11 rounds, I was convinced it was going to be a draw. And you could have made an argument for that result. You could have made an argument for Eggington winning it. Cheeseman was a bit unlucky in the past. So, you know, you don't begrudge him that. And you'd like to see what happens next for both of them. But this is a short, short career. And fights like that, they can only take so many of them to be perfectly honest.
Good point. And they're 24 and 26, you know, the young guys already with some miles on the clock. But to be honest, in the current era and in the current climate, those are the kind of fights that people want to see. And you know, Anthony Farah's entering the fray in the next week or so too. So he's a guy in that division. They could easily have a round robin, throw in another one or two domestic stroke fringe European fighters. And you've got yourself some potential barn burners as well. So I think those are exactly the types of fights that fans are going to want to see. And indeed, maybe TV companies, promotional outfits are going to want to show.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, as we said at the start, I think if we can get this right, if we can get the matchmaking right, then boxing remains the most appealing sporting spectacle on the planet. Two evenly matched combatants going in against each other is a wonderful thing. And it's so simple, yet it seems so difficult. We know that certain boxers, certain prospects will need further education, but we're now at a point where we haven't got that luxury anymore, or those particular boxers haven't got that luxury anymore. We're in, perhaps now more than ever, the entertainment business. We need to show that boxing is an enticing prospect for viewers, that people will want to watch. And for that to happen, we have to have the very, very best fights that are possible. And yeah, that round robin you mentioned there would be a very interesting one.
James Tennyson was on the bill as well. Jordan Gill boxed beautifully on his return to action against Rhys Bellotti, and the British lightweight title went pretty spectacularly, and perhaps, as some might have expected, on form too. Tennyson, ridiculous to think that it's not that long ago he was fighting down at Feather, and indeed, of course, challenging Tevin Farmer at Super Feather too. He's carried his power up to 135.
It was a fearsome display. It was an exciting display. Yeah, the finish was brutal. And you watched poor old Gwyn taking those shots, and it's almost like the skin on his skull was gonna peel off as they just the cut. It was just as those last punches were going in. It was a fearsome display. And the thing that I like about seeing James Tennyson in a fight like that is that he showed he was just as effective at the higher weight, as you mentioned there. I've seen him, you've seen him, we've seen him on the scales before in the past, looking like he should be going to hospital, quite frankly, to get rehydrated, not going to fight the next day. Now, we know why boxers are boiled down, but it's such an old concept now, and it's so, so dangerous. I do much prefer, even though we'll see it and we'll continue to see these boxers on the scales looking like literal skeletons of themselves, only to then magically reappear as the version we recognise the day after. I think there comes a point where we have to say this is exceptionally dangerous to have these boxers boiling themselves down before they go into something as dangerous as a boxing match.
It's the perceived advantage, isn't it, if you can stay to the lowest weight possible. I remember Barry Jones telling me about when he fought Asselino Freitas, of course, the mighty, mighty Brazilian puncher of the late 90s, turn of the millennium. And Barry and his dad saw Freitas at the weigh-in day before their fight, and both kind of looked at him and thought, well, don't know about his reputation, but he's not all that, is he? Look at the state of him. Well, what's there to worry about? And 24 hours later, they saw someone else replace Freitas, and he didn't bear more resemblance to the Brazilian, but he looked about 4 or 5 times the size, almost as if they'd got a bicycle pump and just blown him up. And they looked at each other, Barry and his dad, and went, ah, okay. Okay, now we see it.
Yeah, yeah. And they certainly saw it as the evening developed as well, didn't they? I mean, that was... Yeah, I mean, Barry... I mean, I was taught... Actually, funny you say that. I was speaking to Asselino Freitas a couple of weeks ago for a feature in Boxing News, and He had some really nice things to say about Barry Jones, actually. But one thing he did say was that he dropped Barry Jones 7 times. Now, that actually scraped into the magazine that he dropped him 7 times. Now, Barry Jones was immediately on Twitter going, hang on a minute, it was only 6.
Brilliant. He's brilliant on that, Barry. So, good action at the Matchroom return to action. Fabian Wardley and Dalton Smith are also winners on that bill too. And plenty, of course, to look forward to with Fight Camp 2 coming up this weekend. And Terry Harper, the latest chapter in what's been an extraordinary story. She takes on former amateur star Natasha Jonas. The form lines say that Jonas was defeated and stopped by Vivian Obenauf. And of course, 2 fights ago, Terry Harper beat Obenauf convincingly behind a tremendous jab. 2 fights ago, and of course, she beat Wahlström last time up to get that WBC to go with the IBO title, which she's defending once again. It's an extraordinary story, one that the kind of headline writers and everyone across the media and in the boxing world seem to be latching on to as well. Very, very nearly lost to the sport. In fact, she'd gone. And that seemed like it was that, but for a final text from Steffi Buhl, or Andrew, as she calls him, of course. And what a partnership that's developed, and what a story looks set to roll and roll, unless Jonas can roll back some of the amateur years.
And that is something that a lot of people seem to be forgetting. Maybe the bookmakers are forgetting that. 6-1 against his Jonas, which is huge odds. You would think when you're making odds like that it's a one-sided contest, it's a one-sided matchup. To me, it's not. Now, I can understand why Harper is the favourite. She's coming into this on a tremendous run of form. She's improving. She's younger. She's done the 10-round distance, arguably more comfortably. And she really does appear to have that air of something special about her. But we can't forget that pedigree that Jonas has got, that natural ability. And where she has come from herself, and that level of determination that she has exhibited. Now, we can go back and we can look at a common opponent and say one has beaten one and the other one's lost to it. It's not as simple as that in boxing, as we well know, as we've seen numerous times. I'm not going out on a limb here and picking Jonas to win this one, but it really, really wouldn't surprise me. At 6-1, I think that's well worth a fiver. Well worth a fiver.
It's Matt's picks. Christie's gold for the weekend. We shall see. We shall see. Now, each and every week on The Opening Bell, we're going to take a look back on this week in history. And this week in history, some 50-odd years ago, was a memorable time because Muhammad Ali was in town. 1966, England won the World Cup. And 1 week later, Muhammad Ali was in action against Brian London. London had previously challenged for the world title against Floyd Patterson, losing on points. And that same year, Ali had already defended his title twice against George Shivalo and indeed Henry Cooper. So that was the scene set for a week after the World Cup final. And a very young doyen, soon to be doyen of boxing journalism, Colin Hart, was there to witness him. And we've got Colin on the line right now.
Colin, 1966, a famous year. England won the World Cup against Germany. And then 1 week later, the great Muhammad Ali was in town to defend his world title against Brian London. What were you doing at that time?
Well, I was a very young, believe it or not, sports writer. And I was the deputy boxing correspondent of the old broadsheet Sun. And I was at that fight. It was, as you say, 7 days after we won, should I say, 7 days after West Ham won the World Cup. And I wasn't the boxing correspondent. I was the guy who's running around doing the sidebars and getting the quotes.
And I suspect with Ali in town, it was mayhem. I saw some of the footage of the build-up to the fight. I think he was in London 3 weeks before, and obviously there was open workouts, etc., etc.
Oh, absolutely fantastic, because, believe it or not, when he came over, the promoter was Jack Solomons, and Ali off the plane at Heathrow to the post office tower for a breakfast press conference. And that was the first time I went up to the tower when they used to have a revolving restaurant. And the phone game started from there. Don't forget, he was 24 years of age then, handsome like a film star, and full of himself as always. But of course, he was in terrible trouble in America because of this refusing the draft. And that's why he was on this European tour, because he was not popular, believe it or not, in the United States.
And he was kind of at the height of his powers, wasn't he? I mean, I think Ali himself said that two fights later, when he fought Cleveland Williams, that was just about the best he ever boxed.
Well, do you know what? It was at the height of the powers as we knew him. In my opinion, and a lot of other people's opinion, we never saw the really great Ali, because he was in exile. Those 3 years would have been his greatest.
I suppose Brian London never stood a chance. What do you remember about Ali at that time?
It was like comparing a Lamborghini to an old banger that had found an MOT test. I mean, he was streets faster. I mean, to be fair to Brian London, he did admit years later they never tried to win that fight because he knew he had no chance. In fact, in an interview several years later, he said, "I thought, don't get hurt, Brian, and I therefore didn't try," which was wrong, totally wrong. And I did write sometime after the fight that the noise of Ryan London's knees knocking together was louder than the national anthem.
Never stood a chance. And you covered, I know you and Alan Hubbard both told me about the careers that you enjoyed alongside Ali afterwards. You followed him into the 70s.
I spent wonderful years covering Ali from 1971 to his last fight in 1981, which of course took me to Zaire, Manila, Kuala Lumpur, and his last fight in the Bahamas, as well as all those fights in New York, Las Vegas, etc., etc. It was the golden year of heavyweights, and of course, he was the king.
And what were some of those experiences like for a young reporter?
Well, Zaire was the most bizarre event I ever covered. In the middle of Kinshasa at 4 o'clock in the morning, you might as well say in the middle of the jungle. It was an extraordinary fight. It wasn't a great fight, but it was an incredible occasion. And of course, as I say, being in Zaire, totally bizarre.
Do you have any favourite moment from your time with Ali?
My most favourite was Zaire, because I think there were only two men in the world who picked Ali to win that night, Bob Waters in America, and I was one of them. And when he did, because everybody was suggesting that Ali wasn't going to lose, but he would probably end up in hospital. And Foreman was the great ogre of his day, and Ali was given no chance. And when he won the fight, I must admit, I did something which I'd never done before or since. Most unprofessional. I leapt out my seat and punched the air. And then, of course, I got what I thought was a hero gram from my sports editor, because I tipped Ali to win in round 9. And, of course, he won in round 8. And Frank Nicklin, the sports editor, sent me a hit. I thought was going to be a hero gram. And all it said was, "Why?
As ever.
His way of saying, don't get dickhead."
Very good. Colin Hart backing winners, as ever. Listen, Colin, great to catch up with you. Great to hear that particular story.
And I'm sorry about the voice is a bit croaky.
Shouting home Ali over the years. That's what it is, pal. Listen, we appreciate your time. Thanks.
Okay, take care, a pair of you.
What a time, Matt. What a time to be a young journalist, getting that kind of access. Ali in his underpants in hotel rooms with the likes of Colin Hart and Alan Hubbard and all the assembled press, Ken Jones, all of those guys to have. And we were lucky. We get terrific access from boxers generally. But that, similar to George Best for the football writers, that was a very, very special time. And to witness it alongside a very, very special fighter.
Yeah, it would have been. It's kind of dream stuff, isn't it, to just be invited to Muhammad Ali's hotel room to go and have a chat, and he will just talk and regale you for a couple of hours. That would be wonderful. And no, it isn't quite like that anymore. The media is obviously far bigger. There's far more going on. But I would like to think that, I mean, I'm well aware so often how lucky I am to be in this position. And I think that already you can say that we've seen the likes of Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather. And I think in many years to come, and people will look back on this era perhaps a little bit more favourably than they do now. I'm not saying anybody is going to be Muhammad Ali again. But I think we should count ourselves very lucky as well.
And you spoke to Brian London a few years ago. What, about a decade ago, reflecting on that night?
Yeah, well, a funny thing about that fight, you know, I think London was something like 15-1 underdog going in, and Colin just mentioned there the amount of stick that he got afterwards and that was deserved. You watch that fight again, and you watch that finish. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to. It's pretty easy to find, and there's some fascinating footage on the video as well about what was going on beforehand of Ali in London, etc., etc. But the finish is absolutely scintillating. He gets dropped, London, by the final punch of something like a 13 or 14 punch blitz, which drops London down for, and if he decides he's not going to get up, then that's a decision that he made, and you can almost empathise with it now when you look back. Of course, at the time, people would have been annoyed. But Brian London, yeah, I spoke to him in 2010. I caught up with him in Birmingham, and he looked back on that fight, and he admitted that he kind of regretted not going for it anymore. But on the other hand, he also realised that, you know, even all these years later, that there was very little point. You know, he said that, yeah, maybe I deserve the stick, but I realised early on that Muhammad Ali was so much better than me. And that really wasn't my fault. And you could kind of see what he was saying there. But what a time to go up against Muhammad Ali, 1966. What a fighter he was.
Yeah, he fought and defended that title another couple of times. It was only a year and a half or so later that he'd be out of the game for 3 years before returning and having a fight. And then, of course, 71, the fight against Joe Frazier. I think that was the best of Ali just about. I think he said himself that Cleveland Williams, two fights later, was the best he'd ever boxed. And he just didn't move the same way after the time out of the ring. So I think anyone like Colin Hart, who was around in 66, got to see just about the very best of Ali. And also, in this week in history, in 1997, perhaps some of the best of Roy Jones Jr. too. It was a rematch with Montel Griffin, the first fight ending in controversy 5 months previously in the March, when Griffin, having been knocked down in the ninth round, took a knee, and then almost in slow motion, when you watch what unfolded, Roy Jones grazes him with the right hand, almost pauses, 1, 2, 3, and then follows with a left hook that face plants Griffin, perhaps somewhat theatrically, into the canvas. And unsurprisingly, Jones was disqualified. So that was the kind of scene set, the precursor to their rematch. And we saw in March 1997, Jones lose that O, on a technicality, essentially. But he was pumped for revenge when they met up again 5 months later. And you could see that in the performance.
You absolutely could. I mean, when boxers like Roy Jones lose for the first time, very often their cloak of invincibility has been ripped off them, and it does something to their psyche. It was a completely different fight to that. Roy Jones kind of half sleepwalked through. He had a few problems, but he didn't really come into it, as he often didn't back then when he felt that opponents were far inferior to him. But he came out in that rematch like a man possessed. He really wanted not only to teach Montel Griffin a lesson, but he wanted to teach the world a lesson that he was back. And he came out, and the left hook that he landed, and I think it's about 12 seconds after the opening bell, which connects on Montel Griffin. And Griffin very, very quickly realises he's in a completely different fight to the one that he was in first time round. He teeters backwards. He just about stops himself from falling over, but of course he uses the ropes, and that's the first count. And the second count was both comedic, devastating. It was an incredible finish. If you've seen Mike Tyson versus Trevor Burbick, that one punch that knocked the stuffing out of Trevor Burbick when he went down, tried to get up on those spaghetti legs, but was just smearing all over the canvas. And this is very, very similar. Griffin goes down almost like he's tasered. He can't move. Then he gets the feeling back in his legs, but not as he'd like. And he gets up and he just goes falling all over the canvas. Again, it was another one of those amazing punches that manages to score more than one knockdown. But something else interesting about that fight is that Griffin was with Eddie Futch going into that bout, the great trainer. And due to some commotion over money, the pair of them split up. That can't have helped Montel Griffin, but Montel, the biggest thorn in Montel Griffin's side that night was an inspired Roy Jones Jr.
And Jones went on to defend that WBC belt a dozen times over 5 years before he stepped up to heavyweight, of course, to beat John Ruiz. Not from two in world titles after that, for Montel Griffin, Darius Mikulchevsky, and also Tarver, who he lost on points a few years later too. That was our look back at this week in history in the 60s and indeed in the 90s. And interesting that we talk about Muhammad Ali. Of course, once upon a time, he shared a dressing room, didn't he, with Scotland's great Ken Buchanan when he was in his pomp in the early 70s as lightweight champion of the world. Amazing story. That less amazing is the news coming through recently about Ken falling on difficult times, Matt.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one to hear. It's no secret that Ken Buchanan has, like so many boxers, struggled in retirement. It's a wonderful story about what happened in 1970 when Muhammad Ali, slightly late addition to the bill in Madison Square Garden, Ken Buchanan was headlining that show with a non-title fight. He was the world lightweight champion at the time. And Angelo, there was no dressing room for Muhammad Ali. So Angelo Dundee approached... Ken Buchanan and asked if they could share the dressing room. No problem, says Ken Buchanan, before spotting some chalk on the side and then drawing a line down the middle to say that's my side and that's your side. And at one point, apparently, Muhammad Ali was doing a bit of shadow boxing and accidentally shuffled over into Ken Buchanan's side, at which point Ken Buchanan got up and threatened to clock him, obviously with his tongue in cheek, but they then became great friends. And that was the level of respect. Ken Buchanan was so wonderfully respected all over the world, not least in America. And so it's very troubling to hear that this week he is now in need of going, he's in residential care. He has to rely on full-time care. Now, there are people there for him. There's people that look after Ken Buchanan, and they have just said this is the best thing for him. And I think he was kind of just about clinging on, really. And then lockdown came, and he was drinking too much before, but even the pubs wouldn't open for him. You know, he had no company whatsoever. The people that were visiting him could no longer visit him. So his mind deteriorated somewhat, and we just hope that perhaps if he's in a residential home, that perhaps that will give his mind what it needs. But this is nothing new. Boxing is a cruel sport, and you know, if it seems the right time now to mention what the guys continue to do. Ringside Rest and Care, Ringside Charitable Trust, as it's called. And they're trying to build a residential home to look after boxers. And what they're doing in the meantime as well, they've raised a lot of money, is they help retired boxers that need it as well along the way. It's an exceptional charity. And I spoke to Dave Harris, who set the charity up. And he said, what a shame that we haven't got that care home now. What a shame we haven't had the necessary help, because his idea is a wonderful one. It's that the staff there would be educated on Ken Buchanan's career. He would be able to watch films. He would be able to talk to everybody about his career. And we know, we've seen boxers that are damaged and they come alive. they come alive when they sit and they reminisce and they look back on their career. And I just think it's time for the industry as a whole to look at this issue. Now, more is being done now than it was a few years ago, but it's not nearly enough. We can't continue to champion this sport and then turn a blind eye to what goes on or what potentially can go on when some of these boxers retire. The sport needs us to be there for them.
Yeah, and I think also, and hopefully that charity is going to blossom. It's not just going to be about providing one care home or two care homes, that it's going to be there for retiring boxers and maybe help for them when they're leaving the sport as well, dealing with leaving all of that behind. I think that's why essentially we've got Roy Jones Jr. and Mike Tyson, isn't it? That inability and that difficulty to leave parts of the sport behind and the yearning for it. And I think any retired boxer would mention that enthusiastically. So yeah, let's hope Dave and the team can really push that forward and they'll get backing from plenty of us in the sport. Lots to look forward to, Matt, in the coming weeks as well. We're going to take a look at all the big fights week to week. We'll be speaking to the great and the good of the game as well in terms of interviews. We did want to get Eddie Hearn on this week, but he's right in the middle of fight camp too. So unfortunately, time beat us on that. So we'll try and get Eddie in interview next week and we can catch up on the Warren plea, Olive Branch. Look upon that how you will. We'll get some reaction to that as well as his take on what's happened in fight camps one and two so far while looking ahead to the next. Lots to look forward to in the coming weeks.
Absolutely there is. And just while I have got, and hopefully I've still got people's attention, that I just wanted to say thank you to everybody that has kind of rallied round Boxing News over a very, very difficult period for the magazine. Pleased to say we're still here. We've been producing a magazine every week throughout lockdown. And to all subscribers, to people that have been buying the magazine, I can't thank you enough. I just urge you just to keep getting involved with Boxing News. I mean, some of the content that we've had over lockdown, I've been exceptionally pleased with. And the response from Boxing News readers has been really, really welcome. And thanks everybody here for listening to this one.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks to you all. We'll be back again next week for more of the same from all the team. Bye for now.